All right, my friends, welcome back to Anti-War Radio. I'm your host, Scott Horton. This is Radio Chaos 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. And my guest today is Dilip Hero. Hero? He's the author of 28 books, including Iran Today, The Timeline, History of India, Secrets and Lies, Operation Iraqi Freedom and the Collapse of American Power in the Middle East, The Iranian Labyrinth, War Without End, and many, many others. And recently wrote a great article for the Tom Dispatch about al-Sadr and the Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani and their role in power politics in Iraq. Welcome to the show, sir.
Yeah, thank you very much.
It's great to have you on.
Thank you.
And now, I guess I had seen the numbers reported that about 500,000 people had protested. In your article, you say it was over 1 million Iraqis showed up to protest at Muqtada al-Sadr's call in Najaf last week. Is that right?
That's correct, yes. I think, you know, the police, of course, one knows that whenever a big demonstration happens in any country, police give one figure and the organizers of the demonstration give another figure.
Yes, of course.
And when police said up to 1 million, and the organizers said up to 1.5 million. So therefore, I use the word over 1 million. And it is the largest demonstration ever held in the city of Najaf. So it's a very important event.
And this was basically to mark the fourth anniversary of the fall of the Ba'ath regime, right?
So that's correct. I think if you remember, April 9th, 2003, was the day when Saddam's statue was toppled in Baghdad. And by the way, that particular whole thing was state managed, but that doesn't matter.
Of course.
And, you know, that toppling of the statue was state managed. It wasn't a spontaneous thing done by ordinary Iraqis. What had happened was that, if you remember, a gentleman called Ayman Chalabi, who was a Pentagon poster boy, he had his militia of 600 men. They were ferried, they were flown into southern Iraqi city of Nasiriyah a week before, and on the 9th of April, most of the crowd consisted of the militia of Ayman Chalabi. And people who looked at the pictures of those two gatherings could see the same people. Also, you have to remember that suddenly there were Marines and they arrived with a crane.
Right.
So it all seemed very stage managed, but
yeah,
anyway,
Saddam,
so many things which were, you know, basically secrets and lies.
Yeah. Well, Saddam apparently had the toppling of his statues in mind when he built them, and he made them really sturdy. They needed a tank to pull it down. And, of course, at antiwar.com, we ran the faraway photos that showed that the massive crowd that was depicted on American television was, in fact, as you say, a few handfuls of Iraqi exiles who were brought in with Ahmed Chalabi, but that town square there, whatever they call it, was basically empty of people at the time that this statue was felled.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, as you know, in any hot war, psychological warfare is very important. So from the Anglo-American point of view, it was a great coup in terms of, you know, getting the world attention. And see, if you just go back and make a comparison between, say, what happened in Afghanistan. In Afghanistan, Taliban were in power, of course, until November 2001. But Taliban, being extremely puritanical orthodox Sunni, they did not allow a single image to be posted. There were no posters, there were no statues under their rule. And therefore, when the Taliban fled from Kabul on the night of the 12th of November 2001, and then, of course, the journalists arrived from all over the world, especially from the Western world, they simply did not have any visual image to capture the moment of the fall of Taliban. So the only thing they could do was to actually, shall I say, corral or try to, in quote, persuade some women wearing their, you know, burqas to take them off and so that they could take pictures. I mean, that's the only thing they could do to bring about visual transformation. But in the case of Saddam, you know, and Saddam was everywhere. I remember when I went to Iraq, say, just a year before this invasion, within about 5 minutes, I counted 5 images of Saddam Hussein, 5 minutes of arriving in Baghdad. So he was everywhere. So therefore, it was, you know, very effective to see his greatest statue being brought down.
Right. Now, speaking of the power of images, seeing the massive protests in Najaf and in Kut last week, there were, I guess, you know, if you say 1 million, fine. But, you know, to my eyeballs, there were hundreds of thousands of people in some of these photographs, and they're all waving Iraqi flags, right? Nationalistic flags rather than, Shiite faction flags or some such thing.
Absolutely. See, this was the whole idea. See, the call was given for this particular demonstration by Muqtada al-Sadr, who, by the way, is underground. You know, he's not to be seen anywhere, but he, so powerful is he that whatever his call was given, it was so effective. And, of course, the call was given as a national call for all people who are Iraqis. Therefore, nobody brought in any images or any banners which were sectarian, either Shiite or Sunni or Kurd. Because, see, all of these parties which are functioning in Iraq have their own party flags. Like the Kurds have party flags, the Shiite, 3 Shiite groups, they have their own party flags. None of those flags appeared there. All the banners were nationalistic, and the national flag was there, and that was the whole point. That is, you know, it was a national demonstration, and their main demand was, we want to know when the foreign troops led by the Americans are going to withdraw from Iraq. That was the main drop. Basically, what they were saying, we had one liberation, which was overthrow of Saddam Hussein. Now we want a second liberation, which is the end of occupation by a foreign force. And that was the whole thrust of the demonstration.
Okay, now you say in your article that, well, first of all, I guess, is it correct that Najaf is almost an exclusively Shia town? And then secondly, do you not say in your article that there were many Sunni leaders who came to Najaf to be part of this demonstration?
Absolutely. See, as you know, any demonstration, you know, you always have leaders of the demonstration who stand in the, you know, first line. And that's a, you know, standard practices of any peaceful, disciplined demonstration. And that's what happened. So it wasn't only the Shiite clerics, there were Sunni clerics. Also, there were Kurdish notables as well. And, of course, amongst the marshals, there were Sunnis. How many one cannot exactly tell, because there were 1 million people. And the fact that nobody was carrying sectarian flags, therefore you couldn't say that part is Sunni, that part is Shiite. They were, but so for the first time, so many Sunni leaders, also Kurdish leaders, were in that particular march, leading them. See, what happened was not simply that, you know, it was called given by Muqtada al-Sadr, but it really represents a actual feeling. Because, you see, you probably noticed that, you know, there was a poll conducted recently and by the BBC and the ABC News of the USA, which found that 97% of Sunnis and 82% of Shiites in Iraq are against the occupation forces. See, so I think that is a very interesting figure to keep in mind, that therefore this demonstration was, even though a call was given by a Shia cleric, it's a demonstration which actually showed in very visual and effective terms what is the general opinion and feeling in the whole country.
Right. Now, we've known that basically the entire Sunni community since the war began has been against the occupation, has been, you know, at least tacitly supporting the Sunni-led insurgency. But I guess the common conception is that the Shiites have welcomed us, and it's the Shiites who we're installing in power. They've won the election. They have the majority. And that we have to stay there, and you know, we won't stand down until they can stand up and be the legitimate government of Iraq. But I guess it's really important to note, isn't it, that when we talk about installing the majority Shia in power, what we're talking about is installing a tiny minority of the majority Shia in power. The actual Shiite population, the actual Shiite Arabs of Iraq, they want us out. It's merely the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution and the Dawa Party who need us there to prop up them in power. Is that not the case?
Yeah, I think, see, when it comes to Shiites, even has to, see, they again understand basic the basic facts of life in Iraq. And for that, of course, the book that you mentioned, Secrets and Lies, Operation Iraqi Freedom, and After, actually gives the full understanding of that. When all these books you mentioned are published by Nation Books. But the point is, you see, that when there was a rule by the Ba'ath Party, Ba'athist Party, of course, at the top was Saddam Hussein, and the Ba'ath Party was everywhere in society. Society, in offices, in industry, in military, everywhere. Now, when that particular structure was overthrown by force of the Anglo-American troops, then something which had existed underground came to the surface. What was existing underground was the Shiite religious hierarchy and its network. Because see, the Shiites, even though, or majority of 60%, for historical reasons, they were persecuted and kept down very quickly because Iraq, or what was called Mesopotamia, was a part of the Ottoman Turkish Empire. Ottoman Turkish Empire was a Sunni Islam. And because they were ruled by the Sunni emperor, therefore the Shiites were persecuted or they were kept down, and the Sunni minority in Mesopotamia, stroke Iraq, was in the driving seat. Now, after the end of the Ottoman Turkish Empire in 1918, World War I, when a king was put in place by the British, he also was Sunni. When a king was overthrown by the Ba'ath Party, the Ba'ath Party is mainly Sunni party. So, naturally, if a minority has been in power for so long and if it's overthrown, and of course, it would not like that, would want to come back. That's one. Secondly, the Shiites. And again, to understand that Shiites are much more religious and they have tried to find succor, or kind of a solace, in pursuing religion very quickly. Of course, we're talking of America. Why is it that African Americans are more religious than white Americans? Because African Americans were persecuted, kept down. So when you are suffering in this life, you say, another life, I pray, then Lord will save me, or I'll have a better life in the next time around, etc., etc. Same thing with the Shiites. Therefore, the Shiites have very strong religious a practice and belief, and they had set up their underground network, which functioned without being checked or being repressed by the oppressive intelligence of the Ba'athist Party regime. And once that Ba'athist Party was destroyed, then that whole network which existed before came to the fore. One. Two, among Shiites, there is a religious hierarchy very quickly. If you take the Catholic Church, a cardinal Catholic Church will be like the Grand Ayatollah in Shia Islam. An archbishop will be like an Ayatollah, and a bishop will be like Hujjat al-Islam. Now, this Muqtada al-Sadr is Hujjat al-Islam. He is still quite junior. Now, so you follow what the Grand Ayatollah says, and here, in Iraq, I can say with all my conviction and knowledge that the most important leader in Iraq today is Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani, because he is the Grand Ayatollah. And what he did, you see, this is the point we have to understand. The Sunnis are, still are supporting insurgency, and of course they want foreign troops out. Ali Sistani also has the same objective, get the foreign troops out. He has refused to meet any American or British official or any of the emissaries, but he has said to Shiites, all Muslims, of course, because he is a religious figure, that we participate in the political process, not because we believe in it, but that is the peaceful way to get Americans out. So it was Ali Sistani who issued a fatwa, which is a religious decree, calling and saying it is the religious duty of all Muslims to go and vote. That was the first time when the vote took place, and the Shiites followed him almost to the man and woman. Some Sunnis followed him, not many, because they're very upset to lose power. And that is the first time when 8 million people went and participated in the election. That is the time when you saw these people who dipped their fingers in the purple ink, indelible ink, and that the figures held up. That is an image which Bush and company stole from a Sistani. See, Sistani is following the same objective, but he saw that if you participate, get the representatives into power, and they can negotiate the withdrawal of foreign troops. But I don't think he has changed his opinion. He is using different means, but both the Sunni insurgents and the Sistani followers have the same objective, because ultimately they are Iraqi nationalists.
Right. Okay. Well, now let me ask you about that. Let me try to sum up actually what you just said. See if I can get it right, and then ask you about Sistani's nationalism. Basically, what you're saying, and this has been a very useful analogy for me. Honestly, I'm from Texas. What do I know about Islam? But you say that the Shiites, you can make a rough analogy to Catholicism in that they have one chain of command, the Grand Ayatollah, and then all the other Ayatollahs are under him, et cetera, just like the Pope and the Cardinals and the Bishops, right?
Yeah, I think they don't have a Pope. That's the main point. They only go up the level of Cardinal. There's no Pope. But you see, basically in this hierarchy, the lower grade cleric is bound to accept the ruling or the decree or the opinion of the highest cleric. And the highest cleric in this case is Ali Sistani.
Right.
See, Ali Sistani has acted at every major point in the history of Iraq after the invasion. Now, remember one thing. When, Paul Bremer became the viceroy of Iraq, of course, the first thing was to have a constitution for Iraq. And the original idea, his idea, and Bush's idea was that we have hand-picked Iraqis who will draft the constitution advised by American constitutional experts. And Sistani said, wait a minute. And he was the first one to ask his followers to come out in the street, peaceful demonstrations, which happened in January 2004. Peaceful demonstrations in Baghdad, in Basra, and they said, listen, you are a democracy, and that's what we want. And, of course, Bush and company, yielded to that thing because Sistani was talking sense, And then second thing, as I said, in the next election in 2005, had Sistani not given his religious decree for Muslims to vote, then so many people would not have turned up. You see, so he has been very crucial. And the last thing that he has done is, the Maliki government, under pressure from Bush, has come up with a legislation which will allow the old Ba'ath party members to get their jobs back. Now, this was shown to Sistani, and Sistani said, no way. We're not going to allow that. Basically, that thing is off.
Right. Well, and that's happened over and over again, right? There's been five or six different attempts to bring the Ba'athists back into the government that he has vetoed, basically, right?
No, that's true. You see, again, let me put it this way. Even if that law goes through, I'm afraid all the important or even semi-important Ba'athists have either fled the country or they would be very reluctant to go back to the job, because by now most of the military and police is Shiite-dominated.
Right.
See, so even
it's
if
too late for that
done,
now.
See, basically, it is the Bush and company. They are pushing Maliki to do certain things. You see, he doesn't have the internal or domestic support strength to do certain things, but it is basically the agenda of the Bush White House, which is being thrust down his throat. You see, that really is the basic problem.
Okay, now let me ask you about Sistani's nationalism. My understanding is that he's an Iranian and has refused to even apply for Iraqi citizenship, and that he's much closer to the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution and the Dawa Party than he is to Muqtada al-Sadr, that he's much more in favor of federalism and or even regional autonomy and long-term alliance with Iran than being for holding the Iraqi state together in a nationalist sense. And it would seem like his refusal to allow Ba'athists back into the government, however effective or ineffective they may be at this point, is an example of that. No.
Of course, he was born in the Iranian city of Mashhad. Okay, but I think actually there's a brief biography of him in my other book, The Essential Middle East. Okay, he was born in Iran, but he has been, he is now 70 5 years old. He has lived in Iraq for the past 53 years. You know, because when he became, when he was a theological student, he came to live in Najaf. Najaf is the highest place of Shiite learning in the world. And he has been living there. It was there. In fact, he is an Iraqi national, because he became the Grand Ayatollah in the days of Saddam Hussein. Now, do you expect Saddam Hussein to allow an Iranian national to become the Grand Ayatollah in Iraq? No way. Of course, he is an Iraqi national. He's been living there for all his time. But yes, when he speaks Arabic, he speaks with a Persian accent. There are lots of people who from Britain, they live in America for a long time, they speak the British accent. So I think that it doesn't go against him. But he finally, of course, he is an Iraqi national. Remember also, that is again in my earlier book, Secrets and Lies, on January the 25th, when the American troops were marching towards Najaf during the invasion. Invasion, remember, happened on 20th of March, 2003, local time. And as they were marching to Najaf at that point, Sistani issued again a religious decree calling on all Muslims in the world to help them to resist the invasion by foreign infidel troops. And interestingly enough, I tell you something, because there's in my book I have mentioned that. I try to get that particular information, you know, summary of his religious decree. Not even the French news agency had it. Only the Chinese agency, Xinhua, they had a summary of his decree, which of course I quote in my book. So from day one, Sistani has been Iraqi nationalist. He stands for Iraqi integrity and, you know, territorial integrity. And he is the one who said that hydrocarbons are a national property. Therefore, Bremer dared not privatize oil industry of Iraq. See, so this man is not to be trifled with. He's a very important man, but he does not dabble in day-to-day politics. He keeps himself, he's a recluse, he's essentially a religious man, but when he sees a subject of national importance, whether it's oil nationalization or denationalization, whether it's a question of giving the right to popular representatives of Iraq to draft their constitution for the country, whether it's a question of allowing and not allowing the ex-Baathists to get back their positions in the government. That is the point where he speaks up. But he, of course, he physically doesn't speak up. He has his aides. They speak on his behalf, I think. So ultimately, he is and that's the man America should be afraid of. And I think they understand that he is the most powerful figure.
I guess since he's the supreme Ayatollah, it matters what's his opinion or relationship with the Sadr forces, the Mahdi army on one side, and the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution and the Dawa Party on the other. Those two are the Iran-backed factions, correct?
Yeah, I think, these three parties that you mentioned, you know, Sadr group and, of course, Supreme Council of Iraq, it was actually Islamic Revolution now in Iraq, and the Al-Dawa al-Islamiyah, which is Islamic call. You see, of the three groups, the two groups, Supreme Council, was actually established in Tehran, November 1982. I mean, I happen to be in Tehran doing a particular story, but I mean, so they have a historical connection with Iran. Okay, as far as Al-Dawa is concerned, Al-Dawa actually was established clandestinely in Iraq in 1969. But during the Iran-Iraq War, most of their leaders went to live in Iran, including Maliki has lived in Iran for several years. Before him, the Prime Minister Ibrahim Jafri lived there for 10 years. And so Al-Dawa also has a historic connection with Iran. The only group which does not have any connection, historic connection with Iran, is group of Sadr, because Sadr is so important very quickly because his father, who was a Grand Ayatollah, and his two elder brothers were gunned down by the henchmen of Saddam Hussein in February 1999. Now, they were, as they were coming out of the mosque after praying in Najaf, they were gunned down. Now, at that time, Muqtada, who was the youngest son, he was not with them. Therefore, his life was saved. But he went underground in 1999, and he only resurfaced after the fall of Saddam Hussein. So you see, if you as a Shia and a Shia cleric come from a family where three of your blood relations have been, in quote, martyred or killed, then every Shia is going to respect you because Shia Islam puts a lot of value on martyrdom. You see, the founder of Shia Islam, Imam Ali, he was assassinated. His son, Hussein, he was killed in a very unequal battle. So if you are a Shia, it doesn't matter which party you belong to, the fact that Sadr comes from a martyred family, that puts him, in a place where he is respected, even though he's not an Ayatollah, definitely not a Grand Ayatollah. You really have to be very old to become Grand Ayatollah.
Okay, well, let's see. Last December, for example, when George Bush was meeting with Abdulaziz Hakim in the White House, and the Shiite death squads were going around sticking drills in the heads of, suspected, I guess, insurgent leaders, etc. Muqtada al-Sadr was trying to make a deal with, he had at least one of the major Kurdish factions, and had brought in Sunni religious leaders and ex-Baathists, and was trying to form what they called a national unity government of last chance, or last resort, or last hope, or something like that. And while that was happening, Bush was meeting with Abdulaziz Hakim and saying, you're doing a fine job, Abdul, keep it up. And that fine job, of course, is waging a civil war against the Sunni. I have to admit, I'm kind of confused when you talk about Sistani as a nationalist, but he draws the line at letting Sunnis back in the government. I mean, how can it be? It sounds to me like he is siding, much more with the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution than Muqtada al-Sadr.
Now, I see, again, I'm afraid, you see, in the Sunni, let's look at Sunni insurgency. Sunni insurgency is not a homogeneous body. It has different aspects. There are Iraqi Sunni nationalists there, and there are also jihadists, who you might call the internationalist jihadists, of which Al-Qaeda is very important. Now, Al-Qaeda leadership, especially from the Saudi Arabia, it comes from a small sect within Shia Islam called Wahhabis. Now, Wahhabis in Sunni Islam. Wahhabis in Sunni Islam, in fact, do not consider Shias to be proper Muslims. They call them heretics. So you see, so much of these, you have noticed all these bombings which go on, and including the big one in February of last year when they blew up the tomb of the Shia Imam, because there are 12 Shia Imams, and two of them are buried in Samarra, and that particular mosque tomb was blown up. And that was starting point of division between Sunnis and Shia. Because, see, Al-Qaeda are determined to fight the Shiites. Now, it doesn't matter whether they're fighting Shiites because they are cooperating with Americans or they're participating in the political process, but they are theologically and ideologically against Shias, no matter where they live, whether they live in Pakistan, whether they live in Iran, whether they live in Iraq. See, so that is really the point which has created this whole division and confusion, because those Sunnis who are not Al-Qaeda, they have their own historical gripe in Iraq, because they were, as I said earlier, in power for 365 years, and now they're out of power. They're very angry, and though they want to create chaos and mayhem, so they go along with this anti-Shiite policies of Al-Qaeda, because this is a kind of, shall I say, alliance of convenience. Both have the same common aim, but ultimately, if you ask me, what is the most disturbing, or not disturbing in a political sense, what's the most factor which is creating a lot of tension, etc., is the Al-Qaeda element within the insurgency. And remember, not Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda is only one part. Already, as you know, in the province of Anbar, which is the one province, but Anbar is one-third of the area of Iraq. Now, in Anbar, already Sunni tribes are actually fighting Al-Qaeda, because they say that they are foreigners and they are you know, very anti-Shiite. They don't like that. But you see, in Iraq, things are not so simple. Now, one particular tribe, they say Shamar or Al-Jaburi. Now, some of the people in Al-Shamar are Sunni and some of them are Shiite. But they are the same tribe. And so if Al-Qaeda starts to attack Shiites, no matter what tribe is, etc., that is something which is, creating a lot of problems and so on.
Right, so ultimately, Al-Qaeda in Iraq is a marginal part of the Sunni insurgency, right? I mean, if Sadr could come down, if America was gone, and Sadr and Sistani both said, okay, Sunni former Baathists and local religious leaders, let's make a deal. You guys get rid of Al-Qaeda, and we'll form a coalition government of some kind, etc. If it really came down to that, the local Sunnis wouldn't really have a problem getting rid of Al-Qaeda, right? I mean, Al-Qaeda's the tail and the Sunni insurgency is the dog.
No, absolutely. I think, if you look at some of the basics, if you look at the constitution of Iraq, for example, and it says there are two articles very important. It says Sharia, Islamic law, is to be the main source of Iraqi legislation. There's another article in the Constitution which says that no law shall be passed which is against the undisputed principles of Islam. Now, from that point of view, and the fact that the coalition government in Baghdad is led by three Shiite religious parties, of course, Sadr has withdrawn his ministers, but say, until about last week, and so they are Shiite religious parties. Of course, they are Shiite secular group, which is belongs to Iyad Alawi, and of course, another guy, Ayman Chalabi. He doesn't have a single member in parliament. So, see, the point is that in terms of having Islam as an important and leading factor in the political life of Iraq, there is no dispute on the two sides. This constitution, which was basically put together by the Shiites and the Kurds, has Islam in as a leading place, etc., etc. But you see, it really goes down much deeper. Deeper meaning it's Al-Qaeda. It's not Al-Qaeda's element simply to fight the foreigners, etc., but they are also very much against the Shiites themselves. And the Shiites are, of course, Muslims. Shiites are Arabs. But you see, they're attacking them in such a way, and that is what is the major problem. So in terms of wanting to have Islamic state, the constitution itself is almost practically, you can say, all but in name, it is the Islamic Republic of Iraq. But you see, they have their own agenda, and they really want to, create this anti-Shiite feeling, and which, of course, is very, not only it's, hurtful to Iraq, but you see, if the Sunni-Shiite, maybe next time we can, not next time, but one can go into much further. If the Sunni-Shiite divisions spill over into Iran, into Saudi Arabia, into Turkey, because in Turkey 15-20% of Muslims are Shiite, then into Syria, then it's going to be a huge problem for the oil supplies. Because you see, the Shiites in Saudi Arabia, though they are only 10% of the population, most of them live in the eastern province, which has all the oil. And if they start fighting, if the Al-Qaeda type or the Wahhabis get very anti-Shiite, then the Shiites will rise up against the Saudi regime, and that will mean they will start sabotaging the oil supplies. And that is going to have impact not only in the Muslim world, all over.
Okay,
oil is something we badly need.
Okay, well, so the question is then whether the American presence is making that more or less likely. The president gave a speech or answered some questions, what have you, yesterday, where he said that if America leaves, that Iraq will become a bloodbath, and that is why we must stay. So if America and brought its army out of Iraq in as quick a manner as possible, do you think that the civil war would just go all out, and that it would be, the Shiites fighting for dominance completely over the Sunni Arabs and vice versa, and as you say, the neighbors, the Turkey, Syria, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Egypt, etc., sending their fighters to join in, or is that what's already happening because America's occupying the place?
Yeah, I think it's a very interesting question. In fact, as it happens, I have in front of me here an op-ed published in the New York Times yesterday by Barry Posen, who is the director of security studies program at MIT. And I quote you one paragraph which sums up, and I agree with him. The current civil war, I mean, he's giving a scenario that, you know, Americans leave. The current civil war or wars will escalate. Fighting may indeed intensify after U.S. disengagement. To come to an understanding of how wealth and power in Iraq will be shared, the political forces there must measure their relative capacity and will. The United States now stands in the way of such a measurement, and the U.S. presence delegitimizes any outcome. The promise of a certain withdrawal date by the U.S. may clear the heads of some Iraqi politicians. A negotiated settlement could start to look better to them than escalation of fighting. I think that's what it is. See, you have to allow these forces to really go all out, and ultimately, you see, I mean, I read you another one sentence. Again, I'm reading Barry Posen. Very well summarized. I agree with him. Whatever success is achieved by the U.S., the end result will not be the stable liberal democratic vision of the war supporters. Rather, after lots more killing, exhaustion may set in, deals may be struck, and factions may retreat to tend their own battered gardens, unquote. I think that's what's going to happen.
Yeah, well...
You see, in that sense, you have to go to look at what happened in the Lebanese Civil War. You know, same thing happened. This all sides got exhausted. So I think, and the presence of Americans is making things difficult because the different forces are not able to, as he said, measure up their strength and weakness. The only way is to let them do it and see how far they can go.
Right.
And then they will have to say, you know, see, these civil wars only end, and I speak as the author of the book on the Lebanese Civil War, they only end when there's exhaustion, you know, and the exhaustion can only happen if the Americans don't sit there, you know, try to, you know, have their own policy, their agenda, thrust down the throats of the politicians there.
Right. Well, a couple of things there. I talked with an Iraqi-American, a Shiite named Sami Rasuli, just a couple of weeks ago, and he told me his belief was that if America left, that the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution and the Dawah Party would be out of power, that probably Sadr would inherit most of the authority in the Shiite area of the country, that the Iran-backed parties would basically be marginalized. But, you know, I have to ask you, if you were George Bush's national security advisor, and, I mean, you can see the trouble in selling him a plan where, yes, everything gets much, much worse, but that's how it's supposed to be so that then everybody can work things out. You could see why he would, even if he admits to himself, boy, I really should not have invaded this country. You could see why he wants to, you know, still have the American army there when a political settlement is reached on how the oil money is to be divided up, et cetera, so that, you know, I mean... What you're saying is, Mr. President, pull your troops out. Yes, the civil war will get much worse, but that's all for the better. That would be pretty hard to swallow from the point of view of the person making the decision, probably, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, see, that's true. I think, again, when I look at some certain basics, the basics are very simple. Look at 1991 Gulf War, when Bush Sr. was president. He gave a call to the Iraqis to rise up against Saddam Hussein. And the Shiites in the south and Kurds in the north rose up. And the Shiites in the south, Bush Sr. did not help them. He allowed Saddam's military to use helicopter gunships and artillery and so on and so forth. They decimated the people who did the insurrection. Why? Why? Bush Sr. Because Bush Sr. understood exactly that if Saddam is overthrown, Shiites are 60% population, they will be in the driving seat. In the south, they are 80 to 90% of the population. They will be friends with Iran, and therefore influence of Iran will be next door to Kuwait and next door to Saudi Arabia. He understood, because after all, he had been vice president for 8 years. He was director of CIA, etc., etc. And if he didn't understand, the rulers of Kuwait and Saudi Arabia picked up the phone, talked to him. That's what happened. Now, unlike what happened in 1991, his son, Bush Jr., here is something which really should make us worry. January 2003, three leading Iraqi exile leaders had a meeting with Bush in the Oval Office, that is Chalabi, Alavi, and Conan Makia. And they realized they were talking to the president of USA, who was about to attack Iraq, and he, in January 2003, did not know the difference between Sunni and Shiite. See, I mean, that is something which is really, I don't know what word to use. I mean, this is shocking because he just wanted to get rid of Saddam Hussein. He did not understand exactly what the structure is, what the culture is, what the history is, simply get rid of Saddam Hussein.
Yeah, well, don't be shocked. I doubt if he knows now.
Having done that, you see, if you do, there's a cause and effect follows. If you do what you did, then there's going to be Shiites in power. Now he's trying to reverse the process and keep on blaming Iran. Iran is interfering. You see, the man has no idea. And you see, what I said earlier about Bush, that is in the book by Peter Galbraith, End of Iraq. He mentions that you know, these three Iraqi leaders sitting there 6 weeks before the invasion and 8 weeks before the invasion, and found that this gentleman who is going to do that, he did not know the basic difference between Sunnis and Shiites. So, I mean, that is something. See, and so all this, I mean, I don't have to go through what has happened since then. And so you really have something. And go back to the book by Bob Woodward, Bush That War, when Bob Woodward had 140 minute long, one-to-one interview with Bush, and Bush basically said, I go by my gut feeling. Yeah. So that's what happened. He's just gone by his gut feeling. He hasn't tried to understand, you know, what the implications, what have followed, and there we are. I'm sadly, that's the case.
Right, so basically what you're saying is, if you don't want this bloody civil war that's going to happen when you leave, then you shouldn't have invaded in the first place, but there's no way to stop that now.
No, see, that's what I'm saying. See, if you do one thing, another thing follows. There's a particular logic. And that is why somebody like me or other people, experts, we study history. We see the factors. We see A and B. We see interconnections. Now, this gentleman, he had no interest in that. He simply wanted to get rid of it. Remember, again, in Bush's, Bob Woodward's last book, A Plan of Attack. Now, remember, it was only November 12th that Al-Qaeda and Taliban left Kabul, and Kandahar, where Mullah Omar was not captured yet, on November 21st, 9 days after this, and before the fall of Kandahar on December 8th, according to Woodward in his book, Plan of Attack, Bush almost, you know, gets Rumsfeld by the collar and said, what are the plans about Iraq? What are the plans about Iraq? And so he said, you know, we are working on it. He said, just make it quick. And so this fellow, Rumsfeld, sends off his, a message to Tommy Franks, who was CENTCOM commander. I want this whole thing within a week. And when Tommy Frank gets this, he says, what the hell? You know, I mean, I haven't finished Afghanistan. And they want now the plan to attack Iraq. See, I mean, this is all in Bob Woodward's book.
Yeah.
So what I'm saying is, you know, that, see, and this is basically, what shall I say, criminal negligence of duty of the chief executive of the USA, which is basically war and peace is the most important decision a politician in power can make. And you see on what basis George W. Bush has made his decisions. We can see that now very clearly. Okay?
Yeah, afraid so. All right. Well, thank you very much for your time. This has been very interesting. Dilapiro, he's the author of Secrets and Lies, Operation Iraqi Freedom, and the Collapse of American Power in the Middle East. Thanks again.
My pleasure.
All right, my friends, this is Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. It's Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin, Texas. We'll be right back.